Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to all. My name is Debbie, and I am an alcoholic. Our fifth tradition states that our primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Valley Group honors this tradition by rigorously searching for the finest recovery seekers in the Western Hemisphere so that they can share their experience, strength, and hope with us. Each week, we recognize one of these speakers for their service to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is now time to recognize Valley Group's Outstanding Speaker of the Week. The nominee for this category has a sobriety date of June 6, 1975. He has been continually in service as Secretary, Treasurer, numerous times president of a Sober Writers Club called Sober Writers Brotherhood. And his AA motto is one day at a time. And I consider it a real privilege to be able to introduce this gentleman. I've known him for a lot of years. So, with having said that, may I have the envelope, please? Woohoo! Okay, the winner of the Outstanding Speaker of the Week award is Bo V from Visalia.
I'm Bo, I'm an alcoholic. Can you guys hear me? You know, I haven't a clue what I'm going to say tonight, so hang in there, I guess. But I found out that they're recording this, so I gotta keep my language, you know, good, I guess. And you know, I'm a retired sailor, I'm a truck driver, I'm a biker, and I'm 100% French. Now, if I can keep it clean, anybody can. You know, I didn't grow up in this area. I grew up in a place called Gary, Indiana, you know, and I remember the first 10 years of my life, my folks lived in an all-black community. Now, you got to understand that I had very bright red hair when I was young. I don't have it now, but I did then, you know, and real white skin and a zillion freckles, you know, and I remember when I went to kindergarten, you know, and I was the only white kid in the class. With red hair, blue eyes, a zillion freckles, you know, even the teacher was black, you know, so it was really hard to fit in. You know, the first feeling I got to feel when I got around people my own age and peers was rejection, you know, because I was different. You know, and I don't know how I got them, but somewhere between my mother's house or my parents' house and that kindergarten class, I contacted a disease called cooties. You know, and I really don't know where I got them, you know. I didn't even have sex with anybody before then. But I got to keep this clean. It's getting recorded. But, you know, I didn't know what they were. You know, I thought those things were my freckles. You know, and I remember my Aunt Marie. She told me that if I could kiss my elbow, all my freckles would disappear and fall off. You know, and bless her heart, I really, really tried to kiss my elbow. I almost messed myself up really bad trying to do that. It didn't work anyway. Of course, I don't know, because I never was able to do it. But, you know, I remember my folks took me out of that public school and they put me in a Catholic school a little later on for second grade, actually. But the nuns there didn't think I was smart enough to be in second grade, so they put me in first grade. And I didn't like that. And again, you know, that gave me a resentment, you know, and I think it also added to my cootie disease, you know, and life wasn't real good. Again, you know, I was teased a lot. You know, even by white kids, because white kids were in a parochial school, you know, I remember being in the grade school, you know, the first year I was in grade school, you know, all we had to do was read the, or say the Pledge of Allegiance, you know, stand up and put your hand on, with this hand, put your hand on your heart, you know, and say the Pledge of Allegiance, then you went on with class. Not so in a parochial school. In a parochial school, we had to get up, line up, walk over to the church, you know, and go to Mass and listen to a priest speak in Latin for about 45 minutes before we started class. You know, and we had to sit down and we had to be quiet, you know, and we had to kneel down and we had to stand up a little while and kneel down some more and sit, kneel down, stand up. You know, and being a seven-year-old kid then, you know, it was kind of hard to not wiggle around or you know, just anxious, you know. And the nuns would always sit behind us, and if we wiggled around too much and we were talking to our neighbor or something, we got hit in the back of the head with an 18-inch ruler. I think that's they kept them in their habits. You know, and life didn't seem too good, you know. This is how I learned about God when I was 7 years old, you know, and I didn't, you know, they preached to me about how, you know, if you had so much as one mortal sin on your soul, just one, you were going straight to hell. You wasn't going to, you know, go to purgatory. You wasn't going to do, you're going straight there, not collecting $200 or nothing, just straight to hell. You know, and then they told me that if I so much as thought about sinning, that I was going to go. That was just as bad as if I had done it. So when I reached puberty a little later on in life, I knew I was going to hell. There was no doubt in my mind. You know, because of some of the things I was thinking, you know, it wasn't easy. But I remember in that parochial school, they had a charity drive, and I guess the person whose parents gave the most to that charity drive got to they got a little trophy of the Virgin Mary. You know, and they got to bring it home. Well, my parents didn't donate anything to this charity drive. I'm not sure if they knew about it or what, but they didn't. And so some other kid got this trophy. It was a Virgin Mary, probably about the size of this bottle here, maybe a little higher. You know, and it was, I guess, a trophy or something. I'm not sure what. But I was thinking, you know, that if I could, you know, if I could have won that Virgin Mary, maybe I could have brought that home and it would have cured my cooties. You know, maybe it would have helped take them away. You know, maybe, you know, I could tell my mother a story or something, get a pat on the back, you know, and I could be well again, you know. But I didn't win it. It wasn't mine. But I was thinking, you know, well, maybe I could just take it anyway, you know. So I did. When I got the opportunity, I grabbed it, I snagged it, and I stuck it in my lunchbox, and I carried it home. Now, my stomach started to feel really weird. I started to get these knots in there, because I know what I did. I stole it. You know, and I'm getting this conscience, you know, I'm getting these knots in my stomach, you know, and I'm not feeling really good about doing this. You know, but I'm thinking, well, you know, if it cures my cooties, then I'll probably be all right, you know, and maybe that feeling will go away. You know, and I brought it home, and then I had to lie to my mother and my Aunt Marie and my dad about how I acquired this Virgin Mary. And my stomach started to feel even worse. Those knots got tighter, you know, and man, I hope these cooties, you know, go away, and this would be worth it, but it wasn't. They weren't going away, and I was feeling bad. And, you know, I went back to school the next day, you know, the parochial school, and the nuns were the teachers there. And, you know, the little kid who was supposed to have this little statue was crying because somebody had stole it. you know, and the teacher, the nun, you know, she decided that the topic of the day was going to be the Ten Commandments, and the one in particular was, thou shalt not steal. You know, and I'm sitting there, you know, and to give away my age a little bit, this is back in the 50s, and I was sitting there, it was, I was sitting in an old wooden wrought iron desk, kind of like this, but it had an inkwell right here. And I remember I used to play with the, I was playing with the inkwell, hoping that the other kids could not read the guilt on my face. You know, and I came up with a plan, you know, I had felt so guilty in that classroom listening to all this stuff that I had felt like I had literally kidnapped the Virgin Mary. That's how bad I felt. I don't know if you guys can, you know, understand that, but that is how bad I, my nuts, my guts was all tied up in knots, you know, and I'm just really bad, you know. I'm already 7 years old and I'm already doomed, you know. I kidnapped the Virgin Mary. What's going to happen to me now? You know, I decided, you know, the only thing I can do to probably redeem myself is to let the Virgin Mary escape, put her back where she belongs, you know, and maybe I'd only have to do 50, 60 years in purgatory or whatever and then go to heaven. You know? So that was my plan. I was going to bring it back and give it back to the person it belonged to. You know, so I did that. You know, I stole it from my mother's dresser, you know, and I put it in my lunchbox. And I remember I'm sitting there, you know, and they had recess, and all the kids were going out to recess, so I stole time, you know, let them all go out, and as soon as they were all gone, I reached in there in my lunchbox, and I pulled it out, and just as I was putting it on the kid's desk, the nun walked into the classroom and caught me. Now, you know, alcoholics, you know, I hadn't even started drinking yet. You know, but alcoholics think differently. You know, you would think that someone at my age then, 7 years old, would think to himself, well, it's probably not a good idea to steal, or maybe I shouldn't do that anymore. But that's not the way I thought. You know, what I thought was, I got caught doing it, bringing it back. And I got ridiculed some more, you know, and I developed a whole lot more cooties, you know, and people, you know, life was just miserable the whole rest of the time I was in that school, you know, and I remember I had to stand in front of the class, and the nun was going to hit my hand with a ruler, you know, for punishment. And if I jerked my hand back a little bit, I had to hold it back out there again so she could hit it again. You know, and I realized something very, very important, you know, and I vowed that very day that, you know, the next time I steal something, I ain't ever bringing it back. You know, I hadn't learned much. I hadn't learned much at all. You know, and that was the story of my life, clear up until I got into this program and a little bit after that. You know, every time I stole something after that, I never, ever brought it back. Never. You know, I destroy it, I burn it, I bury it, I throw it away, I give it away to somebody else, and I never, ever bring it back. You know, no matter how guilty I felt. You know, and I don't know, alcoholics are kind of a different breed, I guess. Now, you know, when I was about 10 years old or so, I don't really want to talk too much about my drunkalogue because, you know, I always seem to do that and, you know, and then I don't have much time to talk about what happened after I got in here. So I'm going to try to hurry that up, you know. I left that area when I was about 10 years old and went to Hobart, Indiana, you know, and again, you know, I was having a hard time getting along with all these people. I was in a white area now, and still I could not get along with people, places, and things. I always felt different then. There were other kids that had red hair after that, you know, but I always felt different. I always felt apart from. I never thought I'd match up You know, I always figured that if somebody got to know me, who I really was, they'd reject me and they'd tell me to go get lost and I have cooties and you know, everything is over. You know, I could never find a friendship. You know, I even tried buying friends for a while. Didn't have enough money, I guess. It didn't work either. But I remember I was in junior high school. Now, you know, I'm in about 7th, 8th grade. I'm 13 years old. And I'm thinking, you know, maybe I can get, maybe I can fit into this group of guys, you know, that I had acquainted with, you know, during junior high. And these guys ran around in the cars back then. This was in the 60s, you know, and they ran around in the cars and they drank. Drinking and driving was just a way of life back then, I think. You know, they drank booze, you know, they got somebody to go get it for them, and we drank and ran from the cops. That's what we did. We thought that was cool, you know. Getting drunk. But I thought that, you know, maybe I can be a part of this crowd. Maybe these guys will appreciate me a little bit better. Maybe I can make friends with them. Maybe I can be a part of this. You know, because I wanted to be a part of something. I just didn't know what, you know. So I had used some of my paper route money, and I bought some booze, you know. We got some guy to get it for us. And behind my mother's garage, at the age of 13, I started drinking for the very first time. My folks didn't drink. They really didn't. I think my mother and my dad would split a can of beer on New Year's and not have another one till next New Year's. And my mother used to say, "Oh, no more for me, I'm starting to feel it." That's the type of drinkers they were, you know. So I didn't have, I wasn't around too much alcohol on my inner family. Now my uncles and my cousins, you know, they were all drunks, every one of them. And I remember how my dad would say, "Well, you know, he's just a drunk. He's just a no good drunk. You stay away from him. You this and that, you know." But at the age of 13, I started drinking behind my mother's house. Or behind my mother's garage, my parents' garage. You know, and I was amazed before I was halfway through. I learned a new freedom and a new happiness when I started drinking. I didn't regret my past, nor wish to shut the door on it when I was drinking. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity disappeared when I was drinking. I intuitively knew how to handle situations which used to baffle me when I started drinking. I suddenly realized that alcohol was doing for me what I could not do for myself. That's the only way I can explain how I felt the first time I drank. You know, it didn't matter if I had cooties anymore. It didn't matter, you know, if they didn't like me. It didn't matter. The only thing that really mattered is this feeling. I all of a sudden got inside of me. You know, all those promises, they were extravagant promises. They were only true up here. But that was enough for me. They were true up here. That's how I felt. That's the only way I can explain how I felt. You know, and I'm a child of the 60s. There was a lot of other stuff running around back in the 60s besides alcohol. You know, they say if you can remember the 60s, you weren't there. You know, but I was in the 60s. I was 13 years old in 1965. You know, and alcohol was my drug of choice. It was. Marijuana and other stuff did not do for me what alcohol did for me. Now, I can't explain that. Marijuana just made me paranoid. You know, and I smoked it, but I didn't really appreciate it. And I like I did booze. You know, and I drank a lot. Now, I only drank for a little over 9 years, because I got here when I was 22 years old. You know, I spent most of my life in AA, in this program. I'm 60 years old today. You know, I was almost 23 when I got here. You know, I spent 37 years sober. You know, and life today is a lot different than I thought it would be. You know? I mean, I remember in 71 they had a draft. I was 19 years old. You know, and I went in the Navy to keep from getting drafted, because I knew I was getting drafted. You know? But I still went to Vietnam. That was in the Navy. I was off the coast of it, but I was still there, you know. And I remember drinking was a real good thing to do back then, you know. We had, and you know what? The military back in the 70s, the early 70s, up until I got sober, was the place for drug addicts, you know, because they would send us to Vietnam. Can you imagine the kind of stuff that we could get a hold of in Vietnam? You know, man, I remember one time I'm on the flight deck of an aircraft carrier called the USS Constellation, you know, and I'm an ordnance and I'm working on the flight deck and this plane shows up. It was supposed to come earlier, but the pilot said his tail hook didn't work, you know, so they dingled him over to Saigon. And he, you know, they checked the over and they said it worked or whatever, so they brought him back. And I remember when he landed. Okay, he landed on the ship and he taxied over to where he's supposed to be. And usually the plane captain, after he stops the plane, the plane captain gets up and arms the ejection seat and takes off the seatbelts and stuff so he can get out of the plane. You know, and as soon as that plane got stopped, that pilot did it all himself. He didn't say the ejection seat. He just undid the seatbelt. He jumped out of that cockpit. He ran around to the av bay where the computers and stuff were at. There's some extra space in there. He opened that up. He pulled a couple of big bags of something out of that av bay, shoved it in his parachute bag, and walked off the flight deck. Now, I don't know what that stuff was, but I don't think it was flour. You know? I don't think he was trying to bake cookies. I really don't. But that's just part of it. You know, I, myself, like I said, alcohol was my drug of choice, and I did a lot of drinking in the service prior to 75. You know, I drank some stuff, I'm not even sure whether it was alcohol or not. It might have been formaldehyde. They had something called White Castle rum in the Philippines, you know, and I think it was part formaldehyde, you know, or horse urine or something. I'm not sure what. You know, but it did what I wanted it to do. You know, I was on a carrier, and we're off the coast of North Vietnam, and I'm thinking, you know, well, there's no booze out there. We would spend like 30 days out there, you know, and then we'd come back in the Philippines, and then we'd go back out for 30 days. I remember I used to get a bottle of Listerine, empty out the Listerine, and fill it up with bourbon, you know, and bring it back on board. But then I got in the library over on the ship. They had a little library. And in the library, they had a little book on winemaking. Why would they do that? I don't know. But I stole it. Didn't feel too guilty about it. And I read it from page to page, and I started making my own wine on board the ship, which is a real no-no. And it wasn't real good wine. It wasn't. 3 days. It fermented in 3 days. Some people call it, or the prisoners call that stuff Cruno. It's basically the same thing, guys, you know. And I remember one time, you know, we used to keep it from smelling. We'd have mason jars, and we would put a rubber, you know, a trozen over the lid, over the mason jar, so the gas would expand, but it wouldn't smell. You know, and we would do that. And I remember I was out there for 30 days one time, and we were supposed to come back to the Philippines, you know, and the USS Coral Sea blew its boilers. It was supposed to relieve us. So that it didn't come. You know, we had to do its tour there another 30 days. We had to spend another 30 days off the coast of North Vietnam bombing Hanoi or Cambodia or whatever it was we were bombing. You know, and I had run out of rubbers. Now, usually when we pull in the port, they put a whole bunch of them out there, you know, for a sailor because they're going in the Philippines, you know. So I would always collect a whole bunch of them because I would use those to make that Bruno or that wine with, you know. But I ran out, and I acquired one of those milk containers, you know, that has the plastic bag in it with the yellow with the little holes, you know. And I opened it up, and I threw some concentrated apple juice, some yeast and sugar in there, you know, and I closed it up, and I tied that in a knot, and I stuck it back in a cardboard box, and I put it up, I hid it up in the shop, And we were sitting there working. I worked nights and we were working. And all of a sudden, we were sitting around. And all of a sudden we heard this boom. I did that pretty good, huh? And it was that line. It blew that bag up, you know. And it didn't explode, but it just blew that bag up. And the stuff started dripping, you know, because it split that bag and it just started dripping. And as it was going down the bulkhead, it was taking the paint off with it. I almost cried, you know. But I didn't have any more rubber. So I went down. I went down to sick bay, and I found a quorum, and I asked, because we had just got extended for another 30 days. And I asked, I said, hey, can I get some rubbers? And he looks at me and says, what the heck for? You know? And I had to tell him, you know, and I told him what for, you know. And he said, well, hey, he says, I want some of that too. He says, we made a deal, you know, and he wanted some of that wine. So I had to make him up a batch of wine, but he set me up really well. He got me, you know, you guys know what a gross is? That's a 12 times 12, 144. Okay, now he gave me a case of rubbers, Trojans or whatever, okay, and it was a gross of boxes, 144 boxes in this case, and each box had 144 rubbers in it. I didn't need any more the rest of the cruise, you know, but, and I didn't use them all for wine either, but, again, you know, I come back in 75, you know, and I'm back. I actually got back in 74, and I was still doing drinking. I was drinking a lot, you know. I remember I wasn't doing that well in the military, but I was, you know, like I said, the military back then was, you know, as long as you showed up and did your job, you know, they'd leave you alone, you know. Even if you did your job drunk, if you got it done, they didn't care, you know, because it was a different way. It was a different thing then, you know. It wasn't what it is today. It wasn't the no tolerance thing. They never heard of no tolerance, you know. But, you know, I remember in early 75, I got a DUI. It was 4 in the morning on D Street. You know, and the only two cars on that road at that time of the night was mine and the police car. Now, I used the rationalization or the denial that, you know, I shouldn't have been on that busy street at that time of the evening. You know, 4 in the morning and D Street. D Street, back in 1975, didn't even have a stop sign. Didn't have a stoplight. There wasn't any stop signs or stoplights anywhere in Lemoore. It wasn't that big a place back then, you know. But I decided, you know, that, and I was in a duty status at the time too, and I couldn't make a watch that I was supposed to stand because I was in a drunk tank over there in Hanford, you know, the big room with the glass windows. Has anybody ever been there besides me? I don't know. But I don't know, maybe they changed it since then. It's been a while since I've been there, but, you know, I remember thinking to myself that maybe, just maybe, I got a problem with alcohol. Just maybe. You know, getting a DUI, getting busted for a DUI, you know. Now, it didn't cost me much. It cost me $250 tops. And I got to pay that $50 a month. That was it. There was no live-in program. There was no DUI school. You know, the ticket was just like a regular speeding ticket. That was all it was. You know, it was a misdemeanor. You know, I the only time I had to spend in jail was that first night until I sobered up and they let me go about 6 in the morning. You know, but I was in a duty status and I got in trouble because I couldn't stand that watch because I was drinking. You know, and I had to go to see my CO. They called it captain's mess. You know, when you're in the military, you're subject to another law called the Uniform Code of Military Justice. You know, and that has a whole lot of different rules in it than civil law does. you know. And anyway, I'm standing on that side of a podium like this, and the captain is standing on this side, and he's looking at me, and he's saying, Petty Officer Beaupre, because that's my last name, he says, if you so much as get your nose dirty in the next 6 months, you're going to be an airman recruit instead of a second-class petty officer. And the only thing I was to say, or the only thing I could say, the only thing I was told I could say is, yes, sir. That's it. And then I left there, and I had to go to court, you know, and see Judge Carlos Baker. Now, isn't it funny how we remember those judges' names, even though this was over 37 years ago? You know, but anyway, I had to see him, and he let me go for $250. Actually, the fine was $350, but because the warrant officer went with me, because I had to go to Fallon, Nevada, and they needed all the ordnance men they could keep, you know, so he tried to keep me out of jail. Because they brought the warrant officer with me, the judge took $100 off. You know, off my $350 fine, so all I had to do was pay $250. I'm thinking, man, I saved $100. You know? And I remember when I was leaving that courtroom with that warrant officer, you know, I told him, I said, this has been a tough day. I said, why don't you come down to Smokey's with me over here in the morning, I'll buy you a beer. And the warrant officer looked at me and he said, well, Petty Officer Beaupre, I don't think that's a real good idea. So he didn't go. But I did. And I stayed there until my money ran out and drove home on the same road that I got that DUI on, drunker than I was the night I got the DUI. I didn't learn anything. You know? Didn't learn a thing. But then I went to Fallon, Nevada, and I remember thinking that, you know, alcohol may be part of my problem. I might have a problem with this, you know. So I think I'm just going to quit drinking. I think I'm just going to quit forever. Never again am I going to drink. I should be able to do that. Maybe life will get a little bit better. I'll find some other way to get those promises or whatever. You know, I'll just quit drinking. I wasn't thinking about no promises. I'm just thinking maybe alcohol is just bad for me, and maybe I'll just quit. So I did. You know, and I lasted 5 days. 5 days. We went to Fallon, Nevada. You know, and I knew I'd be real busy in Fallon, Nevada, loading bombs on aircraft and guns and what have you. You know, I was there from like about 4:30 in the morning. I'm on the flight line until about 6:30 at night. Am I running out of time? I hope not. But anyway, you know, Friday came up, and I was thinking, you know, Fallon, Nevada is in Nevada. And, you know, they got drinking, gambling, and whatever, because whatever was legal in Nevada then. You know, and I decided, you know, well, Friday, we didn't have to work all day, you know, and we didn't have to work Saturday and Sunday, and it was payday. So all the sailors got paid, you know, and they're putting on their civilian clothes, and they're getting ready to go into town, you know, and I'm thinking, I've just been sober 5 days, just staying in the barracks and walking a couple blocks out of my way to keep from going by the EM club from the chow hall, you know, and just forcing myself to stay sober, basically. Wasn't happy about it, I was just doing it. You know, I was determined I was not going to drink. You know, and I decided, well, maybe I'll just go into town and I'll have some fun. I'll watch everybody else have fun, but I'm not drinking. So just in case, you know, just to keep from getting stranded somewhere, I cashed my check for $365 and brought every penny of it with me into town. You know, and to make a long story short, I had to borrow $20 to get back to the base. You know, and I remember it's Monday morning, 4:30 in the morning. The sun is just barely getting ready to come over those mountains over there in Fallon, Nevada. I'm on the flight line, and I'm feeling really bad, you know. And it wasn't because it was Monday, because I felt bad a lot of times on Monday with a hangover and what have you. And it wasn't because I was $20 in debt 3 days after payday, because I had done that a lot in the Navy. You know, I'd done that a lot. I had a chow hall and a barracks to live in, so I didn't need that money. I didn't have to eat out of a dumpster or live there, because I had those two things, you know. So I didn't feel bad about the hangover, and I didn't feel bad about the being broke 3 days after payday. But what really, really bothered me, what really made me feel ill about myself was the fact that I knew, like it says in chapter 3, I knew with everything in me that I could not quit drinking. I knew it. Inside, I knew it. I knew somehow, some way, I was going to have to figure out how to control this thing. How to drink and not get in trouble. How to do that, I didn't know. But I knew I could not quit, period. Could not quit. You know, I didn't like that. I didn't like the idea that something like a bottle of alcohol had that much control over me. I'm 22 years old. Surely I should be able to quit drinking, but I could not. I couldn't. You know, and for me to control my drinking, you know, I've never been able to do that. Never. You know? Well, let's put it this way. I've never been able to control my drinking and enjoy it. You know? Never. You know, either I'm controlling it and I'm not enjoying it, or I'm not controlling it and I am totally enjoying it. You know? For me to have one or two beers and to stop abruptly and go home and go to bed or watch TV or whatever would be like going to a brothel to hold hands. You know? I never wanted to do that either. You know? But I can lie to myself, you know, well, I'll just go over there and I'll just gaze into her eyes a little bit, you know, maybe. You know? Maybe one little smooch, but no. I'm not doing that, you know? I never went to a brothel to hold hands. Never did. You know? But drinking was like that for me. When I drank with one purpose in mind, and that was to get drunk. That was to get those promises. That's the reason I drank. I'm not an alcoholic because of what alcohol did to me. I'm an alcoholic because of what it did for me. What it did for me. It did that for me. It made those promises come true. Just like that. Just like that. You know? And what happened was when I was growing up through puberty and everything, you know, I never did anything on my own to try to learn how to get along with life, to try to learn how to get along with you people. All I did when something came up that I didn't like or I didn't understand was I would just go out and get drunk. And either somebody else did it for me or I just never, it just never got done, you know. So here, I remember my old drinking buddy. You know, me and him were drinking together on the base. You know, I omitted a lot of that because I wanted to talk about being sober. You know, but he was engaged to my sister, who was also stationed at Lamar for a short period of time, and then she got discharged. But anyway, my captain said I had to go see him. Now, he'd been sober 2 years, okay? There was no live-in thing there. There was no live-in counseling. There wasn't any of that, you know? All I had to do was go to 90 meetings. 90 meetings, that's it. 2 meetings a week for 90 days. And I had a little index card that I had to go get signed and dated, and I'd bring it back to him, and he'd make a little notation and service record, and then I'd be done. That would have been it. Okay, but I didn't know that. And he was my old drinking buddy, and he knew I had a problem because I drank like he did. You know, and he knew, you know, well, he lied to me. You know, and he told me that I had to go to 3 meetings a week for 90 days. And he volunteered to take me that night. And I'm thinking, you know, if I piss this guy off, he's going to tell my captain, and my captain's going to make me an airman recruit. You know? So I had a hammer hanging over my head. I was being held responsible for my own actions. You want to get somebody in AA? Have them go to jail. I'm serious. The best 12-step, the easiest 12-step work I ever did was when I had to talk through a set of bars. Man, that guy wanted to get sober. You know, he wanted to straighten his life out. He didn't want to be where he was at. as soon as you get out of jail, well, maybe I was over-exaggerating. But, you know, when I was being held responsible for my actions, that's when I wanted to get some help. And as long as I could find somebody to do it for me, as long as I could find somebody to be responsible for my actions, then that just gave me the right to keep doing what I was doing. You know, if I was to write a bad check and somebody would run down to the bank to put money in it to cover that check, the only thing they would tell me is it's okay to write bad checks. You know, I'm that kind of a guy. That's my attitude, you know. I never bring anything back when I steal it. That's my attitude, you know. So I wind up at AA. Now, I didn't think that I needed this program, because when I got here in 75, there was a lot of old-timers kind of like me today, you know. And they talk a whole bunch of stuff, and I'm thinking, you know, well, when I get so old that I can't hand out, you know, that I can't set a bad example, maybe I'll hand out good advice, you know. But I'm 22 years old. Now, my first sponsor, the guy that was bringing me to those meetings, you know, he was 21. And he'd already been sober 2 years. So I couldn't tell him that I was too young to be an alcoholic, but that's not what I thought. I thought I was. I thought that if I could just quit drinking, then I should be able to handle my own life. I should be able to take care of things. I should be able to control what I want to do, you know. I should be able to do that because I'm sober now. I should be able to do those things, you know. But what I didn't realize was that I had no control over life itself. I can't tell you what's going to happen today or tomorrow or the next day. I can't. You know, and all the growing up that I should have did when I was in those adolescent years, I just got drunk at. So I didn't do any growing up, you know. So I had to do it here in AA. And for the first 2.5 years of this program, I didn't do any steps. I did probably the first half of step one. I didn't drink, you know. And then I skipped all the way over to step 13. Yeah! And that's not real good either, you know. I never got married when I was out there drinking. I guess I smelled too bad. I don't know. But I've been married and divorced 4 times since I've been in this program. You know, now I'm not saying that's good. I'm not really proud of that, you know. I'm probably not the guy that you want to talk to about long-lasting relationships. But if you're going through a divorce and you want to stay sober, I'll give you my phone number because I know how to do that. You know? But I think a lot of it had to do with my attitude. A lot of it had to do with, you know, not working the steps to the best of my ability. You know? I think a lot of it had to do with that. You know? Saying I'm sorry promptly when I'm wrong. Man, who wants to do that, you know? I always would come up with an excuse, you see. It was his fault. If I didn't have to do this, if I didn't have to do that, you know. But it could never be my fault. That would mean I'd have to be responsible for my own actions. I don't want to do that, you know. I don't want to take credit for everything that I've done, you know. And then I get on this pity pot and think, well, I'm not getting what I deserve. Man, thank God I didn't get what I deserved. You know, I'd be in prison now. I used to do some jail meetings. I used to do that hospitals and institutions. I went into the Hanford jail a few times, you know, and was talking to the inmates over there, you know, and this and that. And the only difference between them and me was they got caught. And I didn't. That's the only difference, you know. I would walk out of there feeling guilty because they'd actually let me out. You know, but that helped me. That helped me carry the message. I found out in this program that I have to tell you people what happened to me. I have to share my experience, strength, and hope with you guys. Not so you get it, but so that I can stay sober. You know, my attitude is kind of sort of, you know, like if I'm given something real freely. You know, if somebody just does something for me and I don't have to earn it at all, you know, I don't appreciate it, you know. God, my higher power, you know, isn't the same one I had when I was in parochial school. I had to give that one up, because he was judgmental, you know, and he was out to get me. I had to give that one up when I got into AA, you know, and I had to develop another one. And I used the people in the program for a long time. Not any one person, but as a whole, the program, as a higher power. And that helped me out a lot. That helped me out a lot. That helped me develop a power to my understanding, which today is one that wants nothing more than for me to be happy, joyous, and free. Now, the only way I can achieve that, the only way I can hang on to it, is if I give it away. And now, like I'm saying, you know, this higher power should be able to do anything, anything at all. You know, this higher power should be able to make me a normal drinker if he wanted to. Where I can just get zapped or something and I can go out to a bar, have one or two drinks and go home and watch TV or whatever, but leave a half a glass of booze at the bar. Ooh, I don't want to do that. But my higher power can make that possible for me if he wanted to. But like I said, I'm not the kind of guy that, you know, if you do something for me real easy, you give me something for nothing, you know, you make it easy for me, I'll abuse it. You know, just like I abuse booze, you know. So my higher power thinks, well, maybe he's got to earn it a little bit. Maybe he's got to give this thing away in order to keep it. Let's do that for him. You know, let's make him earn it. That's why I'm here tonight. I'm not necessarily here to sober up anybody else. I'm not here to convince you that you're an alcoholic. I'm not here to tell you what you did wrong or what have you. I'm not here for that. The reason I'm here is because I have to give away what I've learned in this program in order for me to keep it. Now, if you guys hear something, if you hear something that you like, something that you can relate to, something that you might be able to use in your own sobriety, great. Great. And if you heard nothing in here tonight, if you're, you know, on your cell phone texting to your buddy over somewhere in a bar, what have you, great. I really don't care. I really don't care. Because I'm more than likely going to stay whole, sober and happy about myself because I've been here sharing my experience, faith, and hope with you guys. You know. I like talking. I don't know if you guys realize that or not. You know, and I like talking about me. I'm my favorite subject. You know, I've been sober a long time, most of my life, but I still have an ego. You know, I have to fight it a lot, you know. I have to tell myself that, you know, I'm not everything I think I am in a bowl of soup. I'm not. You know, I still have a whole lot of character defects. I still do. You know, but I'm happy inside. I liked me today. I think the cooties are gone. And if they're not, I don't care. You know, I'm amazed before I'm halfway through. I found a new freedom and a new happiness. I don't regret my past nor wish to shut the door on it. I can comprehend the word serenity, and I know peace. No far, no far, no. No matter how far down the scale I've gone, I can see how my experiences can benefit others. You know, and I suddenly realized that God is doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. You know, all I had to do was work some steps. I got the steps confused with the Ten Commandments. You know, and I remember I had to memorize those Ten Commandments when I was in that parochial school. You know, thou shalt not steal. You know, and then my mom added a few, you know. She said, it's a sin to masturbate. Holy cow. Man, I'm definitely going to hell now. You know, because I get a whole lot more just think about it. You know, and I didn't go blind. Of course, I do need glasses. What's up? You know, like I said, I didn't start working these steps. I had about 2.5 years sober. Because I didn't think they really worked for me. I really didn't. You know, and I had to try to get along with it. All you people, sober. Sober. S-O-B-E-R. Son of a beach, everything is real. That's what sober meant to me, you know. And I had a hard time getting along with people, places, and things. I didn't like me. Even after I was sober, I didn't like me. I didn't like you. I didn't like life. I was just sober. I call it white knuckle, tight jaw sobriety. Because, man, that's how I felt. You know? And that's why I started working the steps. I had a great motivator. Pain. Emotional pain. You know, something had to give. Something had to give. And I was thinking, you know, after about, I had close to 3 years sober, I was thinking, you know, if I don't work these steps, if nothing changes in my life, if things got to keep going the way they're going, then I'm going to have to get drunk, because I knew what getting drunk would do for me. You know? But being sober for almost 3 years, I didn't want to give up that sobriety. My ego was in the way. You know, so I'm thinking, well, you know, I guess I'll just have to work some more of those steps. And then when they don't work for me, because I didn't think they would, and then it would be AA's fault that I had to go out and get drunk. Again, you see, I could not be responsible for my own actions. I had to blame it on somebody else. You know, so I decided I'd play the game and I'd do a fourth step and a fifth step and see what happens, you know. My fourth step was on a piece of paper like this. Actually, there's more writing on this piece of paper than my fourth step was. My fourth step was double-spaced like this is, big print. And there probably wasn't enough information there to make a good-sized paragraph. But that was my fourth step. It wasn't very much. It wasn't very much at all. And I shared that fourth step with another person in AA. You know? It only took about 10 minutes. But you know what happened? I started to feel a little bit better about me. I started feeling a little bit better about you guys. You know, I started to feel some of the things that I had felt behind my mother's garage at the age of 13. Only this time it was real. It was real. Back then, you know, when I was 13 years old, that felt real too. I'm not going to say it didn't. But this time I actually knew it was. I knew it was real. And I knew that if I was to do some more of these steps, then maybe I'll get some more of this feeling. Maybe I'll get some more of these promises. Maybe I will. So I tried it over and over and over. I could not tell you how many four steps I did, because I don't know. You know? Today I do a lot of 10 steps. You know? And I'm out of time. I know this. I wasn't watching the watch. But, you know, for a guy that didn't even know what he was going to say, I think I did pretty good. Thank you.